And of course, Mike Barra with us, and this is the hour we'll take your phone numbers and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Mike Barra with us. Mike, I'm getting lots of emails, and it's almost unanimous. They think the Inca City is artificial, huh? It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, that is just for, you know, unscientific poll, but you know, you look at it and you've got this larger circular structure, and really, if you when you look at the images that are in the book and that I've put on the web, you compare it to this other fortress, it's exactly the same thing. It's a big circular object, and then everything within that circle, you know, is then a parallel to that outer circle and at right angles to each other. So how does nature make something like that? There's really no good theory, and there's no reason why it would all come out looking exactly like a buried fortress of some kind, or I'm not saying it is a fortress, but, you know, a buried structure with organization to it, if it wasn't really structural. In other words, if it wasn't built by somebody.
Interesting. Well, somebody sent me some emails that Vince DiPietro is out there still, so we'll try to track him down.
And it could be a great show to do.
Greg Molinar, we can't find, but maybe Vince would be able to find out where he might be. And Stuart Robbins, you know, when you were on with me a couple of years ago, I was going to have him on, and I sent him an email, and he never sent me one back, or at least I never got it.
Oh, well, that's really a shame, because he sends me emails all the time under fake names trying to pretend that he's not who he is. And trying to trick me into answering stupid questions. So,
how do you know it's him then?
Well, I'll tell you why. This is actually in another one of the blog posts. At the time, these guys were really going after me, claiming that this one single sentence in my book, that an Ancient Aliens on the Moon, or no, it was The Choice, that said that, you know, the distance between Mars, or no, actually it was in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, the distance between Mars and Earth varied between 34 million miles and 243 miles. And
243 miles, that's it?
243 million miles, and 34 million miles. And they somehow took this one sentence and were twisted it into saying that I didn't know how to calculate an ellipse, that I was calculating the orbits from the Earth using the Earth as a center as opposed to the Sun, which is not true at all. The statement was completely factually correct. Anyway, so this was out there from some of the people that spend their whole lives, you know, listening to everything I say and taking down everything I write and trying to find something wrong with it.
Would you debate him?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I it would depend on what the parameters of the debate were.
I mean, he's a scientist, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, some of his methods, which I've exposed, he's pretty terrible at it, quite frankly. He doesn't really seem to be able to find.
Oh, you guys are going to go at it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he's not a scientist. I'm just saying that as far as I'm concerned, he sucks at it. But anyway, he sent me.
Whoa, Mike, now you can't take these shots at somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Who's not here to defend themselves.
He can't respond. He'll probably call in tonight.
I hope he does.
But anyway, he sent me this email, which was sort of outlining all this stuff, and he gave me this whole big cock and bull story about how he was, you know, worked in a law firm or something, and heard about this stuff on the web, and how did I calculate an ellipse and all this. And so I responded and said, "Give me a break. You know, I know you're not who you say you are." And the first one had a reply, and it said a different name, like, I don't know, Leonard or something. And then the second time he replied back to me, it had a little signature that said Stuart, and it was spelled the way he spells Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T. And then he sends me quickly sends me a third email and says, "Oh, you know, I work in a law firm. I don't want people to know I'm interested in this stuff, and I frequently use different pseudonyms just so people don't really know, you know, who I am." This whole big explanation, and I didn't really realize that was him until later on, when this guy, I get these emails from people saying that this guy Stuart Robbins is attacking me. I'd never heard of him before, and you know, I don't know. I kind of just,
well, if he wants to debate, we'll pass it on to you, and if you want to do it, you want to do it.
So we can maybe arrange that. But look, it came from him. I know it came from him. Who else would be named Stuart that was asking me these specific questions that he'd written?
Well, maybe
about
if he calls, he could admit he did it.
You know? That would be great.
Okay, let's take some calls. Okay. Let's go to John in Hugo, Oklahoma to get things started. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, thank you.
Sure thing.
Back in the 1970s, I was traveling around with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I was on his staff. And Johnny Gray was also there at the same time. He wasn't on the staff. He was one of the rich guys in the 108, but that's another story. But one of the things that came out in one of these private discussions that we had with him was that there was this knowledge in ancient India that the Chinese originally came to this planet from outer space. And so when I was listening to your program tonight, you mentioned that there was a change in the orbit, something catastrophic happening on Mars about 1.35 million years ago. And that's within the range of the four yugas. So we're in the Kali Yuga. The Dwapara Yuga is 800,000 years, you know, before. And we're in the beginning of the Kali Yuga. So then you get back into the Treta Yuga, which is 1.2 million. So that 1.35 million is definitely within the Treta Yuga somewhere. So at the end of the Kali Yuga, everything is kind of destroyed and the Earth gets started over again, like they say in Revelation. But it's possible, or is it possible, and what do you think of the idea that maybe the Chinese were originally occupying Mars because it's so close?
Huh. Well, that's a possibility. Mike, let you react to that.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I know that the Yuga cycles are something that I worked on, did some research on for The Choice, and I think there's a bigger Yuga cycle, which is in the millions of years, and then there's a sort of a subset of the Yuga cycles, which is in the thousands of years, that we sort of go through these. You know, for people that don't know, it's basically the concept of a golden age, a silver age, a bronze age, and a kind of a dark age or an iron age. And it depends on, you know, where the cycle starts to figure out where we are on it, you know, at the particular time. When do you start the cycle? Is it a precessionary cycle? How do you calculate it? But, you know, I suppose it's possible. I don't have any proof or evidence that they're necessarily, you know, Chinese. They don't look like Chinese structures, except that the one pyramid that I do make a comparison to, Pyramid of Elysium in the book, that's also on the website, you know, it the comparison is made to the pyramids that were found recently in China. So I suppose it could be, there could be a connection, but I really don't, you know, I don't really have any specific information on that.
Okay, next call we go. It's Bill in San Jose, California. Hey, Bill, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Bill.
Enjoy the show. I've been listening for over 20 years. Hey, I just want to ask you something, Michael, and I want to ask this to George and get both your opinions. I don't understand why our government and NASA have basically been, you know, been trying to censor everything, pictures and all the, you know, misinformation. That's coming up. I mean, you have the internet now. Everybody knows. I saw a thing over the weekend that said that probably, you know, 70% or 60% of the people on the planet now believe that we are not alone. That they just wish they would have some kind of confirmation. And I'll go ahead and take your answers off the air. And I just want to know you guys do a fantastic job. Just keep it up. Thank you.
Okay, Bill. Well, you know what? I don't know. You know better than I, Mike, if they're holding back information. But let me ask you this: if they are. If they're doctoring photos, if they're just holding back, why?
It's because of the Brookings report.
Now let's go beyond the Brookings report.
Here's the thing, George. Let's use this example. This not UFOs, not aliens, not abductions. Let's use ancient artifacts on Mars. Okay. They sit down at the press conference. The NASA guys get up there with the big meatball logo behind them, and they say, "Well, guys, it turns out that there is actually evidence of an ancient civilization on Mars that used to be there that's not there anymore. It's gone. It was highly advanced, far more advanced than what we have today." What's the first question they're going to get from the press, George? The first question is going to be,
"Why didn't you tell us before?"
No, it's going to be, "What happened to them? Why didn't you tell us before?" is going to be in there, but that's going to be later. The first question is, well, if they were more advanced than us and they're gone, what happened to them? And the answer to that question is they were destroyed in some kind of cataclysm that probably affected the entire solar system, including life here on Earth, probably caused some of the extinctions. Is that really an answer you can see them giving? I mean, do governments generally give out information like that? Even if they knew that there was a potential for a nuclear attack in a major American city, would they necessarily warn us about it, or would they just try to, under the radar, solve
it? Well, the big question is, if an asteroid happened to be heading this way and it could be life-threatening, would they tell us?
Yeah.
Or would they just let it hit?
And they probably would not tell us until the very last moment. And the moment, you know, if they ever did tell us, they would tell us at the very last moment, because you'd have chaos. And it's the same situation here. What happens to people if you tell them, well, we think what happened was that Mars is actually a moon of another planet that exploded? And then people are going to go, wait a minute, we live on a planet. Planets can explode? Wait, you know, I was told there would be no exploding planets when I was born here. That's going to be a problem. And I think that that is the biggest reason behind NASA's compulsion with keeping the information from us. And the fact is, you know, it's not that they hide everything. They don't. But you have to really be interested. You have to be really focused. You have to be really aware of what the information is to appreciate it. You have to be able to look at a picture and say, you know, that looks like a flying saucer sitting in a bunker on that hilltop on the moon. What the heck is that doing there? You have to be part of this community that you have here on Coast to Coast that asks those kinds of questions. And most people don't really ask those kinds of questions because they don't want to know the answer.
We're with Mike Barra, author of Ancient Aliens on Mars. And so I hear rumors that there's a big announcement coming up about a show for you.
Yeah, actually, that's absolutely correct. There is. This is really cool. This is something I've been dying to talk about for about a year and a half now.
You've hinted about this.
I have hinted about it. But in addition to doing, you know, Ancient Aliens, which you and I both have done, I'm part of a brand new show. It's going to be on Animal Planet. The network is going to be Animal Planet, who also does that great show, Finding Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be called Uncovering Aliens. It's going to be a four-part series, and we're going to be doing investigations of UFO sightings and alien visitations is the word. You know, it's hard to
You got to do it without that wow effect, because the other show that they had on, they always tried to pretend a UFO was there or about ready to be there. And come on. You know, it's
I can't, you know, George, I can't. I'm not supposed to, I'm going to tell you who the cast is, but I can't tell you.
Yeah, anybody we know?
Well, actually, Daryl Sims, who was just recently on the show,
Daryl,
the alien hunter himself, he's in the cast. Also, Stephen Jones, who's a very sweet gentleman from England who is an experiencer like Daryl, but takes kind of a completely different view of things. And then Maureen Ellsbury, who is a reporter. She's a UFO reporter for Open Minds magazine, and she's in the cast. So, you know, personally, if it was me, I would have picked me and three women, but apparently...
Oh, yeah, don't you wish.
Yeah, but it's worked out really well. But I'll tell you what, George, this show, the only thing I'm going to say about it is it's going to be different.
Okay. Well, you let us know when's the air date.
Well, the air date's going to be in December. It's going to be a four-part series.
All right, let us know.
It's going to debut in December.
Pop you folks on before it's on, okay?
All right.
Let's go to more calls, more questions. Jeff is in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Sharpfree.
Hi, I was just thinking, like, the face on Mars kind of reminds me of our Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. And they sent the Mars rover out, and it's going to be a while before humans can do any big exploration. Where should they send the next Mars rover so we can gather evidence for, like, the face or the pyramid and see if there's any technology maybe that we can harvest?
Well, yeah, I'd land it right in Cydonia. I'd land it right between the face and the D&M pyramid, and I would go...
I would too.
I would put it right there. And the thing is, it's really interesting, George, is that most people don't know this, but when we sent the Viking probes to Mars in 1976, there was an orbiter and then there were two landers. And by the way, both landers tested for life, microbial life on Mars, and they both came back positive for life on Mars. But the original landing site for the Viking 2 lander was, guess where? It was Cydonia. And then, all of a sudden, right after they got this picture back of the face on Mars, they kind of nervously chuckled and went, ha, 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 yeah, it's just a trick of light and shadow, and it went away later, which, of course, it didn't. After that, they suddenly changed the landing site to an area that was even rockier and farther north, and, you know, pretty much there was no prayer of finding any life there, but they still got a positive test result. So Cydonia has been a landing site before, but I just think, frankly, they'll never go there. I seriously doubt it in my lifetime, but it would be the ideal place to land and, you know, look around for stuff. Because I think that what you'd find on the ground there would just be extraordinary.
Well, if you were an astronaut and you were coming up to the face on Mars, first of all, what would it look like from the ground level? You definitely couldn't see the face. Would it look like just a mountainous structure, or would it look like somebody actually bulldozed and chiseled this out of rock?
It would not look like it was chiseled out of rock, because it's not chiseled out of rock. It is not like Mount Rushmore. In fact, I think very little of the face is rock. In fact, if you go to the eastern side, the left half as you look at it, the right half as you look at it, the left side of the face, the right half from the viewer's perspective, there's clearly metallic panels and things that have shown up in certain infrared images of the face that are huge, geometric-looking, you know, metallic glowing panels. There is these collapsed sort of roofs and structures and things that I've talked about earlier, girders and things like that. So I would think that as you approached it, it would look a lot like that. And the question I have is that as you look at European Space Agency views of the face versus the ones NASA has put out, with the ones that NASA has put out, when you get down to the base of the structure, it tends to get very blurry. It tends to get really plain. There's no detail there. It just looks very blank. And the ones from the European Space Agency, when they did some 3D animations and 3D projections, you see stuff that looks like girders and support structures, like coming, you know, off the side of the face and then being buried into the ground. And you don't see those in the NASA images, but you do see them in the European Space Agency images. So I'm not really sure what you'd see, George, but I think that the European images are probably a bit more honest than the ones we've been getting from NASA.
Let's go to Danielsville, Georgia. Terrell's with us. Terrell, take it away.
Much obliged, George, for you taking my call
tonight.
Sir. And I'm 100% on Michael's side. He's absolutely right about so many things. I have studied Mars and virtually my whole life. And there's a whole nother angle. The Anunnaki, they mined and took away from our planet here countless tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of tons of gold. Mars was a way station. It was also a processing place because it was farther from the sun, less influence from the sun, the solar wind, and all that. They had an atmosphere problem. They had giant processing equipment on Mars. There are artificial structures that look like, I call them launch ways rather than runways, whereby they had these large machines, not like a rocket type, but I call them a spreader. They would launch these things. Being that Mars has less gravity, they could carry tremendous loads of their processed gold for the atmosphere of their planet X, Nibiru, or whatever you want to call it. Mars has, over the eons, had visitations of a number of alien civilizations, as have this planet.
It might have been a landing base. Hey, we got to come back. We'll take final questions with Mike Barra right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Split Show, as we slowly creep to ghost on Halloween night, but we're going to talk about the skinwalkers and also vampires, so make sure you're part of that. And talking about being part of things, how would you like to be part of our television program, Beyond Belief? If you're interested, send an email with your name and phone number to tvshowhelp@yahoo.com. tvshowhelp@yahoo.com. You don't have to physically be there. You'll be part of the show in a recorded question for one of the guests. tvshowhelp@yahoo.com. Mike Barra with us. Mike, so when NASA released the MESA picture of the face on Mars, I mean, the world was disappointed. I mean, because everything was grainy, washed out, the face was gone, obliterated. Why would they do that?
Well, it was all political, George. I mean, the thing is, that's what is so, what's really so wrong about the piece that Seth Shostak wrote in Huffington Post is that it's not a scientific argument he's making. He's making a political argument because this is a political question and it's been a political issue for a long, long time. It's, it, it, you know, we can get into the bigger politics of the destruction of planets and things like that, but it could also be as simple as that NASA just doesn't want anybody else, like the public, dictating to them what they're going to study and what they're not going to study. But in that particular case, you know, there was definitely an intent to try to convince people that there was nothing to the face on Mars. And that picture is the cat box image, as we call it, or it is an outright fraud. And, you know, that was basically proven by Lan Fleming, a guy who was a contractor at NASA, who went through and he tried to reproduce that image over and over and over again. And he couldn't do it until he finally used what's called an emboss filter, which basically takes 3D data and strips it out and creates false shadows. And when you have false shadows and false contrast images, then basically what you get is you get a situation where you cannot really, your eye cannot see where the shadows fall, and you can't discern the three-dimensional nature of the object. So it was done deliberately, and it was totally done politically. So it just, you know, that's why they did it. They did it because they didn't want people to think the face on Mars was real. And is that really an open-minded or even skeptical approach to the subject?
No, I guess not. I guess what keeps driving you, Mike? What pushes you?
Well, what pushes me is my fascination with this stuff and my desire to know the truth. You know, I mean, really, I just want to know the truth. The only way I'm really going to know 100% for sure is to land on Mars, climb the face, and go to some of these areas that I know are structural and say, yeah, see, look, here's the turbocharger. Here's, you know, here's the different instruments, and do that kind of thing. I'm not going to get that opportunity. So what drives me is to try to find the Holy Grail. I'm trying to find something that is so good and so irrefutable that nobody, none of these skeptics, none of the people that want to shoot down all the independent research that's been done on these subjects for years and years and years can deny it. I would like to find, you know, the Holy Grail. I'll settle for a UFO sighting. If I find the Holy Grail of UFO sightings, I'd be happy with that too. Doesn't have to be artifacts necessarily. But, you know, what drives me is just this desire to get to the truth. And having reached a point where I now feel extremely confident that I know what the truth is, I now want to get out there and get that truth to people. I mean, the reason why I joke around and call myself a born-again conspiracy theorist is because what a born-again Christians typically do, George, they proselytize. They can't stop themselves from talking about their reality, their truth. And that's kind of what drives me. It's a desire to wake people up that are willing to be woken up and say, hey, guess what? You know what? The world and the universe is a lot more interesting than all these people, the scientific materialists, I call them, tell you it is. It's way more interesting than that. The universe is way deeper, way richer, way more cool than they let you know that it is.
What do you find so fascinating about space? Did it start when you were a little boy?
I was practically born with it. I mean, from the time I was 3 or 4 years old, I was watching Gemini missions on TV, you know, home with my mom and dad. I can remember Gemini 6 and 7 and 8. I remember watching the launches. There was one where they had a heck of a time getting one of the rockets to go. They tried to launch it 3 or 4 times. And I mean, that's like 1965 or 66. I was 4, 5, 6 years old, George. And why was I watching this stuff? I don't know. I just know that. You know, I was always fascinated by that. I used to love to watch Lost in Space as a kid and Star Trek and all these different shows that were everything about space that I could get my hands on. I wanted to get my hands on. And it's as if I was born with this. And I was also born with this this innate need to question things. Like, it just didn't make any sense to me when we were watching Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the surface of the moon on Apollo 11 for the first time. It didn't make any sense to me why it was this terrible, crappy, black and white picture. I mean, we had a color TV. We were probably lucky at that time. Not that many.
Oh, it was 1969. Not a lot of people had that.
But why couldn't? But I remember asking my dad, "Dad, why didn't they? Why can't they show us this in color? Why didn't they take color cameras there?" And he didn't know the answer, and I later found out when I was writing Dark Mission that they did have color cameras. They just wouldn't let them take them to the lunar surface. Gee, I wonder why that is, and I think it was because they were afraid. They wanted to put the worst possible camera equipment that they could get away with on those missions because they really didn't know what you'd be able to see in the background, and they were very concerned about it.
And what do you think was in the background?
Well, what was in the background is the stuff I talked about in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, which I think is these glass, semi-transparent glass structures that were built, you know, all over the moon by whatever civilization was there, pretty much as a meteor shield, because glass has properties that makes it about as strong or stronger than steel in a vacuum if it's constructed without, molded without water in it. And, you know, I think that's what they were covering up, was the existence of these very, very tall structures. And they had a pretty good idea where they were when they went there, but they weren't positive. So they wanted to make sure that we couldn't get any good pictures.
See, now I've talked to Edgar Mitchell. Apollo 14 walked on the moon. I trust the guy. He says he didn't see anything unusual. Rocks, yeah. Things like that. I don't think he's lying.
You know, I don't know that I'm going to say he's lying either. He's a 32nd degree, or now 33rd degree, Scottish Rite Freemason, which always makes me suspicious because those guys were deeply embedded in the space program. But the thing that's really interesting, and I talked about this again in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, is that if you look at the astronauts, their interviews and so forth, they don't really seem to remember much of what their experience was like on the moon. When you ask them, what did you do?
That's because they're 75 and 85 years old.
But they've never have been able to, George. If you read their technical debriefings, they can recite chapter and verse, the script. We went to this station. We did this. We did that. We did the other thing. But you ask them, how did it feel to be there? What did you see when you were there? What did it look like on the moon? And they don't really have good answers. But one of the astronauts, Alan Bean, who was on Apollo 12, has made paintings of his experiences on the moon. And he originally started out by painting the moon all gray and bland, the way NASA wants us to believe it really looks. Now, if these glass structures really existed, what you would have is you would have light reflecting, refracting, bouncing all over the place and creating basically what would be a prismatic effect, where you would have all kinds of different colors reflected on the lunar surface. You'd have pink and blue and orange and lavender, and everything you can imagine would have been blanketing the lunar surface. And when Alan Bean was not happy with the way the moon looked, he kept repainting and repainting this self-portrait of him on the moon till he finally reached a point where it was, guess what, pink and purple and blue all around him, as if he was bathed in this kaleidoscope of color. And the reason I think that he did that is because he doesn't actually remember that aspect of being there. It's like in his subconscious memory. And one of the things, just to finish this out, is that, you know, we found out during the course of the research for that book that one of the people who actually did the sessions, the debriefing sessions with the astronauts when they came back from the Apollo missions, told us, and Ken Johnson, it was actually Ken Johnson who told us this, was that they were all hypnotized before their debriefings when they were asked, you know, what kind of experience did you have? So, you know, they were hypnotized, quote unquote, to help them remember what they saw on the moon. In fact, I think they were in reality hypnotized to make them forget a lot of the things they saw on the moon.
Back we go with final calls from Michael Vera. We go to Xander in Manhattan. That's in New York. Hi, Xander.
Hey, how you doing, Mike? Good to hear you. It's good to hear you, man. How you doing, Mr. Norrie?
We are well, thank you.
Yeah, I've been listening to you since 2012, man. I've been listening to you talk about Planet X, man, and Mars, man. I got a question to ask you right now.
Okay.
Check this out. Now, you said that about the Mars, that the facial expression. Now, I kind of was wondering, why do they call it the dark side of the moon? I just want to know that.
All right. It's the dark side of the moon because we never see it from here.
Yeah. And in fact, George, there really isn't a dark side of the moon because as the moon orbits around the Earth and it rotates,
it gets as much sun as the other side.
Yeah. The whole surface is illuminated. That's kind of a misnomer that got put out there.
We just never see it.
No, it was a great album title, Dark Side of the Moon, as opposed to Backside of the Moon. And, you know, the thing is that whole ziggurat, the whole pyramid, the Daedalus ziggurat, if there wasn't light on the backside of the moon, we would never have been able to get those images because there wouldn't be any light to take the pictures. So there isn't a dark side, there's just a backside of the moon. And it's just an expression that got coined gosh, I don't know when. I'll have to look it up, actually.
Sid is in Abilene, Texas. Hi, Sid. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, George.
Hey.
I don't know. Did you see that movie Prometheus?
I did not see that one, but I saw Gravity. That was pretty good.
Yeah, the new Prometheus. If you watch this movie, they got a giant in there, and they had Anunnaki.
Yep.
The way you call them.
The Anunnaki.
Yeah, and he had a. They wore a mask like a kind of like an elephant, like with a little bit of a trunk, but not the whole trunk.
Mm-hmm.
The giants did their mask.
Yeah,
shaped
yeah.
Like
it
that.
looks like one of those CPAP machines.
It's like a breathing device. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. Well, there was a still picture that somebody took of the space shuttle with the cargo open, and there was two astronauts standing there talking to one of those guys. And he was a lot bigger than them, too, and you can see it.
Hmm.
Yeah. The depiction of it, I did see Prometheus, George. I've seen it several times.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
That sounds like a no.
It was a nice try, but I felt like there was a few issues with it. But the thing about it was really interesting is that these giant beings were clearly supposed to be the Anunnaki. That was never explicitly stated. But, you know, remember that Sitchin talked about what he called the wing disc, which is the symbol of the Anunnaki. It's a disc with the wings coming out of it. And it's very common in ancient Egypt. It's very common on a lot of the clay tablets and so forth that he looked at and interpreted. And if you go all the way back to Alien, which is the precursor to, Prometheus. Prometheus is kind of the prequel, but Alien was the first film. If you look at Alien now, I've watched it since then, and what I see is that there are corporate logos all over the ship in the original film Alien from 1980, and it has that winged disc symbol all over the place. It's as if Ridley Scott knew about the Anunnaki and knew about all these stories when he made the film. And who knows, maybe he read The 12th Planet because I think it had been out for a few years by then. But he definitely embedded this Anunnaki symbolism in all the way back to Alien in 1980 and kind of came back around full circle with that with Prometheus in 2012. It's pretty fascinating.
Next up, East. Mike is in Erie, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, nice to meet you, quickness, Mr. Norrie. I've been a long-time listener, big fan.
Thank you, sir.
I want to ask your guest a question.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, NASA, you know, that joke about never a straight answer. You know, I've had kind of issues right. with a lot of stuff they have put out about, you know, Mars myself. I wrote a book a long time ago by this guy, Leslie Watkins, called Alternative 3, about a breakaway colony being on Mars. I was wondering if maybe that's some of the reason why they're reluctant to really put out a whole lot of information about Mars. They don't want anybody, you know, bringing that attention to light.
I'm sorry, sir. Was that Alternative 3? Is that what you said? And a colony? Mm-hmm. What was the colony on Mars?
What do you think that, you know, NASA doesn't really want to divulge a whole lot of information? And there's been a lot of chatter on the Internet about the off-world breakaway colony
right.
on Mars.
Right.
What do you think of the possibility of that, I guess?
Well, you know, it's just chatter. There's not a lot of evidence right now. I mean, I used to work, there's a guy, and I don't remember his name, Andrew something, who, you know, says he teleported to Mars back in the...
Andrew Basiago.
Yeah, with Barack Obama and stuff. But, you know, these things are all interesting, and they're really kind of fun to listen to, but they're just stories. And, you know, I'm focused on stuff that I can tangibly verify. And either through visual images, like the pictures that we talk about, or through documentation. You know, people like Dr. Bob Wood do a fantastic job with pulling out secret documents and things and gleaning information from them about the subject. So my only comment on it is that it's an interesting story. At this point, it's just a story. If somebody can come up with some documents talking about the program that can be authenticated, then I'm going to get a lot more interested.
Let's go to John, Agency, Iowa. Hello, John. Go ahead.
Hey there. How you guys doing?
Good, John.
Great.
Well, I've got a question here. It's regarding supposedly Apollo 20, where there was an actual downed mothership on the moon that was actually investigated by Apollo 20 astronauts, and there was an extraterrestrial biological entity that was recovered named Mona Lisa, and I was wondering if your guest had any idea on anything on that?
I've heard the story. Again, I don't know anything about it other than the story, and it's interesting and fascinating. You know, we know that there were 18 Apollos, or at least up to Apollo 18, were actually built. I don't know that there's any evidence that there was an Apollo 19 or an Apollo 20. If there was, I'd become, again, a lot more interested in this story, because right now there's no indication that more than just the Apollos that were built and sent to the moon were actually ever constructed. And the last one that was going to be Apollo 18, which got canceled, is pretty much spread all over the place. I think most of it, I think, is in Florida right now. So if you can show me, for instance, a document where they built two more Saturn V that went unused and nobody can account for them, then I'm going to get more interested in stories like that. As it stands now, I can't, there's no evidence. I can't really, you know, do anything except interesting story, and I'm open-minded to it.
And did you see the movie Apollo 18? It was interesting. Yeah.
I thought it was really well done. I mean, they did a great job, I think, of recreating the look and the feel of those moon missions. It was pretty spectacular from that standpoint.
Michael, where do we get the book, Ancient Aliens on Mars?
Ancient Aliens on Mars, you can obtain it through Adventures Unlimited Press, which is the publisher. You can go there directly, and they will get it to you right away. It's now available on Amazon.com. And you can order it from them, and you should be able to get it in your local bookstore any day now. It usually takes about a week to 10 days after they get, you know, the books are printed for them to actually make it into the stores. And I got my copies, so I just got them 2 days ago. So I would start looking for it in stores in the next couple of days, and it makes a great Christmas gift, George, if I do say so myself.
Yes, it would. Keep in touch. If I get some emails back, we may very well get you back for the debate, okay?
Okay, sounds great.
All right, and Tom needs to talk to you. Mike Barra here, book, Ancient Aliens on Mars, and the website, of course, hooked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.